Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. It is June 4, Thursday. Welcome to Morgan Stanley Asia Macro Webcast. My name is Crystal Ji, Asian EM Market Strategist. Before we start, please note that this session is for Morgan Stanley institutional clients and financial advisors only. It is not for member press. If you're a member press, please log off and reach out separately. Please also note that this webcast and your questions may be recorded. Today we have Jun Suk, South Korea Market Strategist and Head of Korea Financial Research, Kathleen Oh, Chief Korea and Taiwan Economist, Zhipeng Cai, China Economist, Chloe Liu, China Market Strategist. During this session, you can send us questions at any time from the Ask Question text box. Today we have Kathleen here, and then can you share your views on the May trade data, and then also whether there is a broad-based recovery in the economy. And then also last week we have the BOK meeting, and then there seemed to be a more hawkish turnaround. Can you also provide some updates on policy path?
Sure. Thanks, Crystal. Hi, good morning, everyone. So May was a historic month for Korea's export sector. The export data have broken all-time high. And of course, this was driven by continued strength in semiconductor and tech products. But we also did observe some improving trends across the non-tech and some of the final goods categories as well. So taking into the account of semiconductor export unit prices, it's likely to continue the uptrend looking through the second half. And also we are looking at the global CapEx cycle rebounding, as well as a potential geopolitical tension de-escalating down the road. We do think the upside risks to Korea's exports in the second half of the year are even greater at this point. So looking closely at the data, on the headline in May, we had the exports surging 53.2% year over year. It was the highest monthly export value at $87.7 billion. This accelerated from 48% in April, beat market consensus. And it was a strong number in the fact that it was 3.5 fewer working days in the month, but also the import slowing down helped with the trade surplus recording another monthly high on record of $26.9 billion. So overall, year to date, exports from January to May grew 43.4%. Same time, semiconductors, of course, led more than 45% of the growth, and non-tech still recording two-digit growth over 14%. So the story is quite resilient, helped by the semiconductors, but also on the overall wider export trend going into the second half of the year. Specifically on the semiconductor exports, of course, skyrocketed another month, 170% year over year, and accounted for 43% of total exports. Memory pricing is doing a lot of the heavy lifting here. The DDR5 16 gigabyte price was up 682% in May. NAND flash price also up 800%. These are some of the extraordinary numbers, and they do reflect the structural demand shift driven by the AI infrastructure build out globally. And also not just semiconductors, but the related computers, as in the solid drives exports. It also surged 290%. Strong shipments of favorable memory pricing spills over to other hardware categories, as we're observing. And that trend, coupled with our own house view of bullish semiconductor demand outlook, we do think this trend will continue to stay strong, lifting the overall exports trend going into the second half again. The non-tech story, a little bit of a laggard, but year to date, we do see them rising 14%. Especially in May, auto exports was a bit of a weak spot there. It fell 5.9%. More driven by the fewer working days. And of course, we do see a structural shift in that there is an increase in the U.S. Domestic production by some of the Korean automakers. And there was some supply disruptions due to the tensions in the Middle East. Other traditional manufacturing sectors, machinery, steel, they did show a bit of a recovery trend, but on a slower pace. Some of the bright spots were, though, we did see the K culture related exports doing very well. Of course, the final goods of the noodles, cosmetics, seeing a jump in their the growth numbers, although the total share of them in the total exports still remain below 7% of exports, but we do see quite a surge in those final consumer goods export areas. Higher oil prices did help the petroleum product exports. They did surge over 40%. Petrochemicals also doing okay, 11% up. Of course, some of the stabilizations in the volume term, but the unit price again lifted the overall exports for May. Regional breakdown, we did see China showing demand accelerating to 80%, which was quite notable number. It was actually mostly driven by some of the tech goods export. And we do think there is some of the inventory rebuilding story across the electronic supply chain there. Exports to the U.S. was, again, a strong number, another close to 60% increase. Resilient demand on chips, of course. And the autos did a bit of a weakening trend there. But, of course, the tech goods was the main driver for the exports to the U.S. We do see continued story in the tech demand cycle, pushing up the demand for Korea. And of course, the imports side was a bit of a disruption from the higher oil prices. But at the same time, the semiconductor imports and the chip manufacturing equipment imports continuing to rise. So those was mostly consistent with the Korea's own capacity expansion for the semiconductor exports, which does give a leading indicating for the continued export strength in the semiconductors for the coming quarters, especially the second half of this year that we are looking for another close to 40% increase in exports on the headline. So overall, we continue to remain constructive on the Korea's export outlook. Of course, we do think the tech upcycle does remain a prolonged secular structural story from here. We especially do think in the second half, we do see the tensions in the Middle East de-escalating and the oil prices coming down potentially. Then coupled with the semiconductor upcycle story and the global CapEx cycle rebound, the second half again story, we are putting even more upside risk to our growth forecast on this basis. So with the strong export story, of course, the BOK came out with a very hawkish MPC meeting last end of May. I mean, the decision itself was a no change decision as widely expected, but the tone of the meeting was quite hawkish, as in they were signaling an immediate rate hike as soon as July. So there were two dissenters in the seven-person committee calling for a hike. There was the dot plot, which signaled even three hikes within the next 6 months. But mostly the median number was two hikes for the next 6 months. And also the tone of the new governor, Governor Shin, at his first press conference was widely signaling that he preferred to raise rates as soon as possible, as he mentioning that all the data, including growth, inflation, FX, and the housing market even, the across the data all are pointing to a hiking cycle coming around quite soon. We did change on this, our call for WOK now. We were looking for three hikes in the cycle, but now we do think, along with the strong export data and the tone from the BOK, this hiking cycle would come faster, as in earlier by a quarter, and could be longer in its duration. So we do think the first rate hike is coming in July and is likely to come with the four total rate hikes in the cycle, to the terminal rate of 3.5%. Currently, we do see the quarterly 25 basis point hike starting from July through second quarter 27. Again, as we were pointing out that there is an even higher upside risk to the export growth, we do think the risk balance is actually to a faster front-loaded hiking cycle, even potentially with the back-to-back hikes in the case where we do see a lot more stronger number on the export front and also in terms of the pass-through onto the inflation on the domestic side. I would also just lastly briefly point out that the May CPI inflation print just 2 days ago coming out higher than the consensus again, marking 3.1%. Although we do think the second quarter could be a peak driven by the oil price staying elevated. But in the second half, the picture should be that the inflation could slow down at the headline, but the composition of the inflationary pressure would come more from the domestic demand side of the pressure rather than just the oil price shock. So in that sense, we do think the BOK will maintain its hawkish stance for a prolonged period, as in through the rest of this year and onto next year as well. I'll stop here and pass back to you, Crystal.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. So now we are moving on to equities. KOSPI again had a great run this year. Today we had June to share his views on whether this rally will continue in the second half, and then whether you see any rotation coming, and then what might derail the bullish run. And then from here, do you actually see any near-term risks for people to watch?
All right, thank you very much, Crystal. So KOSPI on Tuesday was at 8,800 level for the first time ever. And today it's down a bit because of the Middle East situation. But, external factors will matter continuously for the market. But there have been some events that, played out in the past week, which were uncertainties at some point. But actually, I think it gave the market a bit more confidence towards the rally. So one topic that we've been getting a lot of questions on is actually domestic liquidity and retail investors, how they're kind of playing the market. So we've seen a lot of, foreign selling here. But we've seen retail net inflows of 64 trillion won year to date as of Tuesday. And, there's also the local institutions which have been buying, and this seems to be more linked to ETFs. So if you look at ETF balance right now, it's actually above 500 trillion. And, as of end of the last year, it was at 296 trillion. So a very big, big jump here. The launch of the single stock leverage ETFs, I think, for last week for Samsung and SK Hynix was quite an important one because, we kind of got an idea of where retail investors are and what they're thinking about. And if you look at the 16 ETFs that were launched, and if you just exclude the inverse ones, we saw actually on the first day, the AUM grow to like 4.3 trillion won. As of Tuesday, it's at around 7.3 trillion won. So it's still growing. And when you look at the trading volumes, it's at around 10 trillion won. So obviously there's a lot of interest in the chip makers and the AI story. But one thing to note is that, we've seen a big skew towards, a very small number of stocks going up. And, if you look at last week on May 27th, actually 8% of stocks only went up and the remaining were flat or kind of lower. And, if you look at the past few days, it's been, generally the fact that there has been more, stocks down or flat. So, it does.
请关注公众号, 思维纪要社, 更多纪要请加V,CN2021-1030.
I think prove that retail investors are very much interested in the AI story and continues to be committed. And also, there's been a bit more, I think, focus on SK Hynix, which has actually performed somewhat better for the ETFs. And our tech analysts recently did come up with a report, and the title was kind of Chipflation. So we are seeing AI really, turning memory into like a structural bottleneck. We do think that prices will, continue to go up. And, generally here, when you look at, CPU and memory demand, we continue to see that, numbers are going up here. So in terms of, you know, kind of questions on the tech side, what we get a lot is on AI capex, financing, and, you know, rate of change of consensus earnings. And for now, I mean, none of these issues seems to be a drag. And second quarter earnings also looks to be quite strong. So our call right now is to stick to the chip makers and also the peripheral beneficiaries. Now, the other event, which was just the day after the launch of the ETS, was the National Pension. So they came up with a five-year strategic allocation plan. And I guess all eyes was on, you know, what would be the allocation target for domestic equities for this year. And it ended up being at 20.8%, which is slightly higher than expectations. And there was actually no mention of actually extending the temporary suspension of rebalancing, but they did actually say that the strategic asset allocation buffer would be lifted. And they haven't given us a number, but previously it was at 3%. So I think overall, what we kind of look into this is that, number one, the long-term allocation for domestic equities still seems to be on a downward trajectory, probably. The second is that while there could be some selling pressure in the second half, it does seem to be quite manageable. So I think we've kind of gotten over that actually the week before that even, and hence the national pension issue is less of a factor at this point. Today we had, well, yesterday we had the gubernatorial elections, and the results are coming out. Rather than the results being quite important, we always kind of thought that it'd be more of a barometer thing to see how the voters are looking at the ruling party, and seem that they did get more seats here. But the key race was actually the Seoul mayor race, which is almost completed in terms of the counting of the votes. But right now, the incumbent conservative mayor does seem to have a lead of a small margin. But the reason why it's important, because it's kind of linked to the real estate market and the policy there. So that's something that we're still looking at and something that we're going to have to follow. Now, as we get through this elections, I think the focus is going to be once again on policy. And we do think there's a second wave for the reform story in the second half of the year. After all these commercial code changes, there's been a bit less momentum, especially in the news flow. But we do expect that the Capital Markets Act revision, the anti-stock price suppression bill, and a lot of the other initiatives will start to kick in. And we also have cumulative voting also kicking in from September. So we do think that the reform story gets more legs as we get to the second half. And that's why we're kind of saying focus more on the financials and also the HOCOs as this kind of happens. And just on the banks, I mean, we also like the banks that are levered well to the equity market and the wealth effect. So that would be like Shinhan and KB. And just on the industrial sector, there's been a correction the past, couple of weeks. This is for power generation, nuclear and defense names. I think the focus has been a lot more on chip makers and hence not so much interest or these subsectors being overlooked. But the other trend that we are seeing is that, a switch from the leaders maybe to the laggards, and particularly for the power generation side. But for defense, somewhat different story. Our preference has been more to the land system side rather than air defense, as we've been equal weight LIG DNA and Korea Aerospace. But obviously, we did have the accident at Hana Aerospace, so we have seen a pullback. But overall, we still see that the defense exports, especially on the land systems, is going to be a structural growth story. So we are kind of waiting for a catalyst to play out, which should be, some sizable orders coming in. So just lastly, I think, for Crosby, we still do lean to our bull case, which is 10,000, and maintain our stance that, first half is going to be stronger than second half. And for second half, there's a lot more, I think, external factors out there that we need to look at. And for now, we stick to the winners, and that's why we have industrials, tech, autos, and also financials together with healthcare as kind of a barbell in terms of sector allocation. I'll stop here.
Thank you so much, Jun. That's super comprehensive. Before we take any questions on Korea, let's move on to China first. And then today we have both our economists and also our strategist, Chloe, to talk about the K-shaped economy and also the latest views on Chinese equities. So first up, we have Zhipeng together with us. Can you share the views on whether you think the K-shaped economy is sustainable or not based on the new the marketing feedback?
Thanks, Crystal. Basically, the team did a lot of marketing after we published this mid-year outlook. I think the dominant consensus is that China is in a two-speed or K-shaped economy. On the one side, exports, high-end manufacturing, this AI-related supply chain remains quite strong. And on the other side is the relatively weak construction-related activities and consumption. And I think Chloe will also talk about is that the bifurcation is reflected in market pricing. With assets related to technology exports or technology upgrading performing better, while names related to property and consumptions, have relatively lagged. But let me highlight the two non-consensus calls. The first one is on housing. I think there has been some recent improvement in housing indicators for sure, but we think it should be interpreted relatively carefully. We think that year-to-date stabilization has been concentrated in the so-called small-ticket homes in higher-tier cities, and they're driven by idiosyncratic factors rather than broad-based beta factors. For example, first one on how a price adjustment for these small-ticket homes have been more sufficient and drastic in the second half of the last year, and that means, in terms of the fundamentals like rental yields, they are more attractive right now. And during this price decline last year, this also accumulated some pent-up demand. Number two, there's also some seasonal demand for these particular type of homes, for example, due to this school district registration. So there's also always some seasonal demand at the year beginning for these small ticket, apartments. Number three, the housing purchase policy easing year to date also benefit these homes in particular. For example, the housing provident fund loans, they are probably smaller in size, so they are particularly skewed to benefit these small ticket homes, and also the home purchase relaxations in higher tier cities. And finally, these cities such as Shanghai, Shenzhen is also still having population inflows as opposed to the broader tier one, tier two cities where, population flows are probably more balanced on average. So all these suggest to us that these improvements in the second home market year to date is more idiosyncratic rather than beta. And we think that the broader housing market is probably not yet ready for a sustained rebound. If you look at all these fundamental indicators, for example, inventory, measured by inventory months, they remain relatively elevated at the aggregate level for tier one and tier two cities together. And rental yield for the broader tier two cities remains in a downward trajectory, putting downward pressure on prices. And finally, as I alluded to earlier, it's the household income growth is also quite K-shaped. So without a broader recovery in household consumption, household confidence and income, a durable nationwide property rebound is still probably not yet supported. So having said that, we still think that the property sales data from June to August is still important to watch, because houses are still an asset market and asset markets can move ahead of fundamentals. If these households begin to believe that prices have bottomed, then the transaction volume may recover and the stabilization might come earlier than we expected based on all these narratives, which can become self-fulfilling. So the next 3 months is probably the key to watch. So that's the first non-consensus call on housing. The baseline is still about.
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 V CN 20210130.
A L-shaped path over the next 2 years, but the risk is that all these narratives become self-fulfilling. Then our second non-consensus call is that we are above consensus on real GDP growth, but at the same time we do not expect additional major policy easing. This may sound a little bit self-conflicting, but the reason that we are above consensus is not about domestic stimulus. It is more about stronger external demand amid this global CapEx supercycle. So let me share my screen. So basically, we expect that over the next 1 to 2 years, we are going to see basically a global CAPEX supercycle. And for China, I think it's deeply embedded in this supercycle on AI with all these data centers, computing infrastructure and related, you know, electronic equipment. So China is very strong in this intermediate goods and equipment. And at the same time, for the energy transition, we think the demand is also being triggered or reinforced by the Iran conflict, driving EVs, batteries, solar products, etc., and also power equipment and grid. So on the back of this AI and you know, energy transition equipment, energy transition demand, we think this global CAPEX cycle is not just a near-term story. It is probably a structural story over the next 1 to 2 years. And more importantly, I think for China, this export cycle is slightly different from 2 years ago, for the past 2 years, in the sense that it is driving nominal GDP. In the previous 2 years, in 24 and 25, we think that, you know, the export resilience is often achieved through price cutting by the exporters. So if you look at the left-hand side chart, you know, the volume, export volumes were very strong. But at the same time, you know, if you look at the right-hand side chart, you know, these prices and profits were still, was largely underwhelming. But this time around, we think exports are more clearly backed by global demand. So exports are also supporting nominal GDP growth and creating a narrow reflation. This still helps China on the margin because China was stuck in deflation for many years. And so even a narrow reflation can be somewhat beneficial to China. So overall, we still think, you know, 4.8% GDP growth for the full year, although second quarter might be soft due to the peak oil shock and some fiscal policy complacency. We do think second half can be slightly better than the second quarter. But of course, that's conditional on the partial normalization in the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, we know the situation there is still very fluid. But that's the overall reason why we are above consensus on real growth while expecting very limited additional easing. But of course, the deeper question is, how long can this K-shaped economy continue? And can we just say that the old economy simply does not matter anymore? I think, you know, to answer this question, it's probably more nuanced. As I alluded to earlier, this K-shaped economy can probably be sustained for another 1 to 2 years, because, you know, it's an investment supercycle. And the new economy sectors with the strong exports can support aggregate economic growth. But in the longer run, we don't think the divergence is really a stable equilibrium, because the transmission from the growth drivers to the broader economy has drastically changed in China. In the past, the main drivers were like property infrastructure and lower value-added exports, which by and large were labor-intensive and also credit-intensive. But today, the growth is increasingly coming from high-end manufacturing and technology sectors, and these sectors are more capital intensive and also skill intensive. So they do not automatically transmit to the broader household income and consumption in the same way as in the last 10 to 15 years. So this is why we think that supporting the old economy and also facilitating the spillover from tech to non-tech sectors is very critical over the longer run. And particularly for China, with its very high debt to GDP ratio already, nominal GDP growth is crucial. And if the old economy continues to drag and the new economy related reflation remains narrow, and this could probably prolong the debt deflation overhang on the economy. And that is why we think, you know, the rebalancing reforms are important, and we'll continue to monitor a few of these over the next few years. Number one is about clearing the property market. Basically, we think the policymakers need to further allow the market to adjust, but also at the same time provide backstop to prevent overshooting. This will mean that the best case outcome is that this housing related drag will not prolong for indefinite future. And number two is to really adjust the local government incentives and the tax system so that it can probably help to prevent or renege the ongoing over-concentration of resources in the supply side. And finally, you know, strengthening the social safety net to reduce broader, you know, precautionary saving is also a very important way for China to rebalance. So with these rebalancing reforms, we think, you know, China might be in a more like self-sustaining ecosystem where technology is driving growth, but it's also spilling over to the broader economy. But at the same time, strong demand in the, from the broader economy is also providing sufficient market and profits for all these entrepreneurs and innovators to undertake these more riskier activities. And that's probably a more self-sustaining equilibrium over the longer run. So to summarize, basically our view and the market consensus is that the K-shaped economy is probably going to be sustained in the near term. But over the longer run, our view is that China still needs to rebalance the economy to reduce its reliance on exports and also domestic policy easing to drive growth. And I'll stop here and hand it back to Crystal.
Thanks so much, Zhipeng. Last but not least, we have Chloe together with us today to share the latest views on Chinese equities. And then also, do you still see the divergence between upstream versus downstream to continue for the second half? And then can you also share the key feedback from investors during your marketing trips?
Sure. Thank you, Crystal. So on the China equity market, currently we still remain constructive on the specific sectors and thematic investment opportunities. While at the index level, we expect a modest upside for around 10% over the next 12 months. So the opportunity is more at the stock picking level instead of a more broad beta market. So for the upside for the index, it really comes down to the earnings growth. Currently, we forecast around 7% earnings growth for MSCI China and 10% for CSI 300 in 2026. Both are meaningfully below the consensus estimate of 14% and 18%. The reason is that while we do see some earnings recovery in the upstream sectors, like energy and materials, the weakness in consumption means that we don't expect a full earnings recovery across the board until we see a really pick up in consumer spending and also pricing power downstreams. It's really hard to justify the more optimistic consensus numbers. This is also what the latest first quarter 2026 results are telling us. So at the aggregate level, it's still a net miss for the earnings, but the magnitude has narrowed meaningfully, especially for the Asia market. The net miss has narrowed from a negative around 23% in the fourth quarter of 2025 to a net miss around 13% in the first quarter this year. So we do see the industrial upcycle is clearing playing out. The upstream energy, materials, and financials are delivering solid results. But the mid to downstream sectors remain under pressure, especially on consumer and autos. They are struggling to pass through the cost. So the earnings picture is really like a tale of two halves. Upstream is recovering while the downstream is still lacking. But looking forward, we expect a potential improvement in the earnings trajectory starting from the second quarter. There are two key drivers behind it. First is in the wake of the Middle East conflict. We see a lot of countries globally, they are ramping up their capex on the energy transition. And given China has a strong competitive position in the green energy supply chain, including like solar batteries and electric equipment, so we see these Chinese companies are well positioned to capture a larger share of these export orders. And our accounting also forecasted the China's share of global exports to increase from 15% today to 16.5% by 2030. And secondly, back in April, we see the government have stepped in with tighter regulation on the food delivery price oil among the e-commerce platforms. Actually, this was a big drag on the internet companies' earnings over the past few quarters. And currently, we are already seeing that, like Meituan, their loss has been narrowed faster than expected in the first quarter. So we think the earnings drag from this price oil could start to moderate from the second quarter. So taken together, we see the earnings picture could improve from the second quarter. Secondly, on the Asia versus offshore debate, we continue to prefer the Asia market. So year to date, we see the CSI 300 has posted around 6% return. This has been outperforming the MSCI China by around 12 percentage points. So there is a very significant gap. So our preference for the Asia is based on three reasons. First is on the sector composition. So currently the Asia, they do have a much higher concentration of this high-end upstream manufacturing and also hardcore tech companies. So these sectors contribute around 40% of the CSI 300 index weight versus just 13% in MSCI China. And we continue to make these sectors as a multi-year investment theme. And secondly is for the Asia IPOs, we have a lot of highly anticipated Asia IPO names like Changxing Memory, Yangtze Memory, and also Unitrin Technologies. So these could generate significant participation from the domestic institutional investors and also retail investors. And certainly is that for the Asia market, we do see ample domestic liquidity, which brings us to the flows picture. So when we compare the foreign fund flows with the domestic flows, as we think the onshore side comes with much greater visibility. So on the foreign flow side, yes, we do see the mutual fund inflows into China has been very strong in 2026. And actually the first 5 months of total inflows has already reached around 80% of the full year 2025 level, which is encouraging. But we want to highlight that the inflows are purely driven by the passive funds. So these are from the ETFs. And then for the active funds, we continue to see outflows on China. And also with the very strong performance of other emerging markets like Taiwan and Korea, actually we see these foreign mutual funds, they have deepened their underweight on China. So for example, for the EM funds, currently they are underweight China by around 6 percentage points as of data of April, comparing to just 3 to 4 percentage points underweight on China at the start of this year. And on top of that, we think the delay in the Fed rate cut is also a headwind for the emerging markets liquidity broadening, including the Hong Kong market. And another thing I want to highlight is that this year we have a lot of IPO lockup expiry in the Hong Kong market. The total value is around Hong Kong dollar 1.5 trillion. Comparing to just around Hong Kong dollar 600 billion in 2025. And in particular, we see July and September stand out as the heaviest ones with a lot of IPO lockup expiry. So while for the onshore Asia market, we think it is a very different story. So we estimate that there was around maybe 7 trillion of excess saving accumulated over the past 2 years from the households, particularly since the COVID. And now with the deposit rates declining, some of that is starting to migrate into the equity market. We estimate there is around maybe 1 trillion shifted into the equity market in the second half of last year. And in together, so we think the declining deposit rate, a more decent equity market performance could continue to encourage this migration. And this has already been shown up quite clearly. For example, for this private fund AUMs, we see it's up 40% since July 2025. And also for the margin financing balance, it's continued to hit record high in April and May. So in general, we think the Asian market has a much stronger liquidity support than the offshore market. And then on the sector allocations, we continue to recommend the upstream sectors with less AI disruption risk and also that could benefit from the China's rising global export market share, including for sectors in materials, industrials, energy, and also semiconductor. And also specifically on China's global export champions, we have identified 25 names that could benefit from China's rising export shares in the upstream and high-end manufacturing. So if you are interested, feel free to reach out for more details. And lastly, I will talk also a little bit on the investor feedback. I think the two questions come up most frequently. The first one is about the extreme positionings and overall divergent sector performance. So currently, the AI-related trades have clearly dominated the market, just as Julian has pointed out also. But based on our current conversation, I think most investors still agree that with the launch of the agentic AI, we see the AI penetration increase rapidly across specific industries, and we are still in the early stage of this adoption curve. And given the tight supply and abundant demand, the sector setup still looks healthy. And also the key drivers for this share price performance comes from the earnings growth. So for example, for the leading memory names, despite the strong rally, the P multiple still stands at only around 5 to 6 times PE. So most investors remain comfortable with this valuation. That being said, I think the market is mindful of the near-term corrections risks if the trades get too concentrated in the short term. But in the medium term, the view is quite consistent. So as long as the demand stays strong, the structural uptrend should continue to hold. And the second question is about the Hong Kong market. So the Hong Kong market has underperformed the CSI 300 by around 8 percentage points year to date. And specifically for Hang Seng Tech, it has underperformed by 16 percentage points compared to CSI 300. So when could we see a turnaround on this? We think there are two key things to watch. First is if there is any meaningful improvement in the LLM capability and also monetization outlook from the major hyperscalers. So this could help rebuild investors' confidence in China's tech companies. So the market needs to see a clearer path from the AI investment and also the AI revenue. So that's something we are watching very closely. And the second is that if there could be any stabilization in the overall macro and specifically for the consumption names. Because for the most of the internet, consumer services and also consumption names listed in Hong Kong, the macro and also the spending backdrop is very important for the revenue growth and the margin trends. So any signs of consumption stabilization could be a meaningful catalyst for their earnings outlook as well. With that, I will stop here and pass it back to Crystal.
Thank you so much, Chloe. Now we are moving to on the Q&A session. And then now we have one question for June. So you mentioned that industrial companies, including defense, has had some correction lately. Do you see any positive catalysts from here? And then also, can you also talk about, just now you mentioned you are relatively more constructive on financial and holdcos. Can you also talk about your sector allocation in the whole of Korea?
Yes, thank you. So for the industrial side, I think you have to kind of separate the subsectors. But first of all, on the defense side, there are, I think, concerns out there that if there is any kind of, let's say, ceasefire or kind of simmering down of these conflicts, that demand for, defense spending demand may actually come down, or these orders may not come through. But we believe that if there is any kind of simmering down, actually, that would be kind of the opportunity where we see orders coming out. And this includes Eastern Europe, Middle East. I think, when you are in this kind of conflict situation, and also, there's uncertainty about how your budget's going to move. Certainly, I think you're making key decisions right now may be a bit difficult. So we need some kind of big new orders to come out for the defense side. And this is probably similar also for the shipbuilding side, which also is kind of linked to the defense side. So some, like one of the big orders that's right now pending is the Canadian submarine order. Probably more of a 27 story, but still just need to kind of follow the news flow. I think for the other kind of sectors within the industrials, again, I think a lot of it is going to be linked to the orders, but there's also a technical, I think, issue here, which I would say is that so much attention is right now on the AI and the memory sector that we probably need to have that attention being somewhat moved away. And I think because of the launching of the single stock leverage ETFs, that kind of happens. So today, I think we're seeing a bit of a more equal kind of a movement, more kind of a broad-based move up of stocks right now. So, and I think that's another factor to look at. And just on the, you know, you asked about holdcos, but on the holdcos, there's basically a lot of linkage with the holdcos with the tech stocks, for example. So SK Square, Samsung C&T, Samsung Life are all seen as proxy stocks. So if those stocks do kind of underperform like we are seeing today, then similar kind of trends happen. But overall, we do think that the corporate DNA change is going to actually take place. So kind of mid to long term, we do need to look at the conglomerates separately, but there could be upside there. So, you know, we still like the industrials, tech, the autos, and as a barbell on the kind of the more value side, the healthcare and banks. Let me stop here.
Thank you so much, Jun. In the interest of time, we'll conclude today's session here and answer the remaining questions offline. Thanks so much for joining us, and do reach out to me and the team if you have any other questions. Have a nice day and see you next week.